A field is the continuum of probability distributions for possible functions of time. In other words, the field by itself is just pure potentiality. It is the continuum of all possible energy and information states that will subsequently manifest as space-time events. And this body is nothing other than a little flash in the pan of eternity. A space-time event, a quantum space-time event, and the mind is even a further cloud of space-time events. And we are not the space-time events. We are the ones that generate the space-time events, including time. Time is the frequency of self-interaction in that continuum of eternity. How I experience time varies or differs according to my state of consciousness. If I'm having a good time, time flies. If I feel that I'm running out of time, then all clocks move faster for me, and my biological clock moves faster as well. People constantly use the expression, I'm running out of time. They literally have faster biological clocks. Their heart rates are faster, they have higher levels of growth hormone, glucagon, insulin, etc., and they suddenly drop dead of premature coronaries, they've run out of time. If your internal dialogue is, I have all the time in the world, then your biological clock mirrors that. Or if you're in love, or having the experience of bliss, or if you're watching the stars perhaps, or one day you're listening to some music and it takes you into the timeless, as when you experience the following version of an expression, the beauty of the mountain was breathtaking, time stood still. Because in the timeless, what really happens is that the observer, the observed, the process of observation resolve into one unified wholeness of experience, where the observer no longer feels experientially, knows himself or herself or itself as separate from that which is being observed. Because the fact is that that which is being observed is the observer. That which is being observed is the observer. And when we have that unified wholeness of experience, the peak experience as Abraham Maslow called it, or as the Vedic Rishis call it, the experience of unity consciousness, then when we are experientially grounded in that unity consciousness, then there is no difference between the observer and the observed, that knowledge, which is really the experience of pure love also. It is the experience of pure love, because in pure love, you no longer feel separate from the beloved. You are the beloved. That's from where some of the greatest poetry comes. In one of his most memorable places, Tagore says, the same stream of life that runs through the world and dances in rhythmic measure runs through my veins night and day. It is the same life that shoots in joy through the dust of the earth into numberless blades of grass and breaks into tumultuous waves of leaves and flowers. It is the same life that is rocked in the ocean cradle of birth and death, in ebb and in flow. My limbs are made glorious by the touch of this world of life, and my pride is from the life throb of ages dancing in my blood this moment. When we experience that life throb of ages dancing in our blood this moment, then we have the restoration of the memory of wholeness. This is the basis of Ayurveda. As is the atom, so is the universe. As is the microcosm, so is the macrocosm. As is the human body, so is the cosmic body. As is the human mind, so is the cosmic mind. It's easy to talk about the cosmic mind in the church of today. But in a scientific conference, we usually don't call it that. We call it a non-local field of information with self-referral cybernetic feedback loops. So as is the human mind, so is this non-local field. And if all is self-interaction, the immediate question is, who's having this self-interaction and where does it exist? And I want to spend just a little time on this. Because I'm not the thought, I'm the thinker behind the thought. I'm not the doubt, I'm the doubter behind the doubt. And all these so-called aspirations that I have are in the field of space-time. I'm beyond the field of space-time. That's why, again, the Rishi says, both anxiety and hope are born in the imagination. When one is grounded in reality, one is free of both. Because why would you need hope if you didn't have anxiety? One implies the other, and they're both in space-time. Me is beyond space-time. Dr. Wilder Penfield, a very well-known neurosurgeon, credited with all this stuff we know today about the right brain and the left brain and motor cortex and sensory cortex. One of his most well-quoted, well-recognized experiments is one in which he was stimulating a certain part of the motor cortex, and the patient's arm started going up like this. And he asked the patient, what's happening? And the patient said, my arm is moving up. And he said to the patient, are you moving your arm? The patient said, no, my arm is moving up. So he said, well, in that case, why don't you move your arm in the other direction? And the patient proceeded to do so. Now, no matter how hard you look, no matter what instruments you used, no matter what sophisticated technology you have, you'll never find with any instrument or any sophisticated gadgetry the location of the one who made the choice to move the arm from here to there. You'll find in the brain the location of that which executes the choice once it's made. Once the choice is made, then you'll find the location. So, for example, I ask you, choose between this and this. Choose this. I will not find in his body or in his brain that which made the choice this and not this. Once that choice is made, then I can find in the brain the location of that which executes the command. But where is the commander? Where is the commander? The commander is not in space-time. I will not find it in the body. The commander is choosing the body to execute those commands. It's not in the body. The body is in it. It's not in the mind. The mind is in it. It's not in the world. The whole world is contained in it. The choice maker, the commander, is nowhere and everywhere at the same time. That choice maker is nowhere, everywhere at the same time. And it's in the gap between our thoughts. It's in the gap between our thoughts. The gap is the quantum fluctuation. But where does that quantum fluctuation emerge from? From the void. And in that gap is hiding the commander. That gap between thoughts is the window, thought. Right? Right now as I'm speaking to you, these are space-time quantum events in that unified field. So if I say, I'm going to take off my shoe, I can change that statement to say, I'm going to put on my shoe. Or I can change that statement to say, I'm going to make a phone call. I'm going to have strawberry ice cream. I'm going to pay you a compliment. I'm going to take a flight to Italy. Between the going to and the next thought is a little gap of silence, which is a field of infinite possibilities, infinite choices. That gap is my corridor is the window, is the transformational vortex through which my individual self communicates with the cosmic self, which is non-local and everywhere at the same time. The cosmic mind is whispering to me in the silent gap between my thoughts. And me, my soul, my individual self, is the continuum of these gaps which are interrupted with my thoughts, which are space-time events. And even though this gap is a field of all possibilities, in that there are infinite choices in each gap, I hope you agree, infinite choices in each gap, yet each gap is qualitatively different from the other gap. This is the mechanics. Slip into the gap, have the desire, release the attachment to the outcome, and let the universe handle the details. It's handling them anyway all the time. It's doing that all the time. The earth is spinning on its own axis. It's hurtling through outer space. A human body is connected to that field of infinite correlation. Infinite correlation. Where everything is infinitely correlated with everything else. Any human body is that same field. A human body can think thoughts and play a piano and kill germs and eliminate toxins and digest food and monitor the movements of stars and make a new baby all at the same time. And not only do all these activities at the same time, it correlates all these activities with each other all the time. So that is the mechanics, and higher states of consciousness are nothing other than your ability to go into that gap, because space-time are structured in that gap. Dr. Ellen Langer, a Harvard psychologist who's written a book called Mindfulness, talks about an experiment on aging that she did a few years ago when she advertised in the Boston Globe that she wanted 100 people all over the age of 80 to participate in an experiment. And the experiment was that she took these 100 people to a little monastery outside of Boston, and in that monastery she created an atmosphere, a sensory-rich environment from the 1950s, late 1950s. She had Elvis Presley rock and roll music and Chevy Impalas parked outside, Walter Cronkite reading the news, except he seemed to have pimples on his face. And when he spoke, gave the news, it was about Nikita Khrushchev and Fidel Castro. When they watched movies, it was Alfred Hitchcock. Everything was created from the 50s, the fashions, the dresses, Life magazine, etc. And she said to them, be as you were in the 50s. Be as you were in the 50s. And after 3 weeks, she found that they had reversed their biological markers of aging. Not stopped them, but reversed them. Their visual thresholds changed. Their hearing thresholds changed. Their systolic blood pressure went down. Their skin became more elastic with more fat under the skin. Their wrinkles disappeared. Their bone density on X-ray changed with sophisticated techniques like bone densitometry. She did hormone levels, a hormone called dehydroepiandrosterone sulfate, which is an adrenal steroid that goes, it's a sex hormone that goes down as people age, but this started going up in these people. Everything that she measured in 3 weeks, it had reversed. And not a little bit, but by several years. All she did was create an environment from 30 years ago and tell them, be as you were in the 50s. Don't reminisce, don't think of it as in the past, but be as you were. And just being as they were, that's what happened. She brought them back to Boston after a few days. They reverted exactly where they'd started from. So what we call everyday reality is nothing other than a socially programmed hypnosis. It's an induced fiction that we help participating in and creating. And if we can induce this kind of hypnotic trance and make it so real that it becomes real for us, then why can't we do it another way? So this afternoon when we start again, we'll be speaking together, and I really feel a great privilege to be here in your presence, in the presence of Jack Poland, and in the presence of Wayne and Marcy Dyer, who have become really good friends of mine. And I'll end with a short quote from Franz Kafka to show you that this doesn't have to be a path of effort. The main thing is to bring about that carefreeness inside us, because this is a carefree universe that is orchestrating itself by itself without any interference. And Franz Kafka, who usually wrote very depressing stuff, said in one of his most brilliant insights on the path to knowledge, he said, "You need not do anything. Remain sitting at your table and listen. You need not even listen. Just wait. And you need not even wait. Just become quiet and still and solitary. And the world will offer itself to you to be unmasked. It has no choice. It will roll in ecstasy at your feet." Thank you very much.
When two extraordinary people sit down and talk to each other, the air becomes charged with a special kind of energy and excitement. Our program continues with just such a conversation. Let's now join Dr. Dyer and Dr. Chopra.
Who's going to go first here? This is actually something that we have talked about doing in our private conversations, of which we have many, for a long time. And it's the very first time that we have ever sort of dialogued together. One of my favorite movies of all time was My Dinner with Andre. If you haven't seen that, rent it. And it's just two people having a conversation for the world to see. And that's sort of what we envisioned here. I had 1,000 questions as you were talking. And my first reaction to what you were doing is we all talk about there's one, this unity, this oneness, and yet in our lives that we live every day, we see separateness. You know, we drive different cars, we go home to different people, we have different families and so on. And I remember at our first lunch in Seattle that afternoon, we were talking about the mind-body connection. Somewhere in one of your books you said that, 90% of the doctors do not believe, was it, in the mind-body?
That was a survey done by the American Medical Association, short for AMA, which you might know what that is.
Yeah. The junk.
And, they once did a survey of doctors, and apparently 90% of doctors that they surveyed didn't believe in the mind-body connection. And recently I gave a lecture at one of the institutions in Boston, and I won't name it for now. And my brother's a faculty member of Harvard Medical School. And afterwards, one of the other physicians went up to him and he said, "Do you really believe all that your brother does?"
Well, I thought the great question that you asked was, if 90% of the doctors do not believe in the mind-body connection, you know, like, how do they all wiggle their toes?
Yeah, how do they wiggle their toes?
Yeah. And that's the question. You see, if the same God or intelligence or infinite intelligence, that organizing intelligence, runs through you, let's say. That runs through me. There's only one. There's not a different God for you and a different God for me and a different God for everyone. There's one in us. And I know that that commander that you were talking about that I can't get a hold of is what allows me to wiggle my finger. Okay? I ask that question. And I ask this of audiences. I know that there's a thought, and then there's a thinker of the thought, and the thinker of the thought says, move your finger, and I'm able to do that, and yet I can never get a hold of what it is that allows that to happen. And if the same God that allows that to happen allows you to wiggle your finger, the question is, why can't I wiggle your finger?
The reason you can't wiggle your finger is that you call me you.
Mm-hmm.
You think of me as somebody other than you, so
exactly.
You can't wiggle my finger.
Okay.
See, because despite what we're saying and we're doing here, you still think you're Wayne Dyer and I still,
mm-hmm.
I'm Deepak. We're both God pretending to be Wayne Dyer
mm-hmm.
and Deepak. And that's how God plays his game, or her game.
Mm.
Hides herself to find herself.
Mm.
It's just a play. It's like playing Hamlet or anything else. You've got to make the play interesting.
Mm.
So it has to have a sinner and a saint and a victim and then a hero. And basically, the sinner and the saint are merely exchanging notes. They're both God.
Mm.
The saint has sinned and the sinner shall be sanctified. But it makes the play interesting.
Mm.
That's why.
What I suggest and what I think about is what we're conditioned to from the time that we are born and the time we come into form is to believe in our separateness. I mean, that's really what all of the conditioning and education is about. You are you, and somehow you are distinct from me. Meditation, transcendental meditation that you practice, meditation going within, shatters that illusion.
It shatters it slowly. I mean, every time you break a boundary here and there. And the analogy is frequently given that it's like dipping a cloth into a dye. Let's say you have a white turban and you want to make it red or orange. You take it and you put it in this dye. And then you take it out, and then a little bit of the color is there.
Mm-hmm.
And you put it out in the sun, and it'll fade away. But a faint hue, a tinge will remain.
Mm-hmm.
Then you take it again, break a few more boundaries, put it back, and you keep doing it till one day it's there forever.
Mm-hmm.
And you can put it in the sun, you can put it anywhere, and now that can't be overshadowed.
Yeah.
So every time you contact the self, which is beyond the self-image, then a little bit, a glimpse into eternity, a glimpse into immortality. You keep doing it and doing it and doing it till ultimately you carry the consciousness of eternity no matter where you go.
Is there a place where I will be able to go within and wiggle your finger?
Absolutely. It's a measure of the degree to which you access the gap. Can I
sure.
Elaborate on this
yeah.
a minute? Let me first of all tell you about a patient that I had 2 years ago, because I got a real good glimpse of this with him. You've heard the story before, and I'm sure some other people who've perhaps read my book have heard it. Bob's 28 years old, and he was repairing an antenna one day. And he touched a wire that he thought was dead, but in fact, it was a live wire that had 12,000 volts of electricity in it. So as soon as he touched it, he died. And the mechanism of death is that the current goes through your body and creates ventricular fibrillation. The heart stops. And as it happened, he fell from the roof and fell to the floor, and he happened to fall on his chest. With the exact location, precise angle, precise impact to start another electrical current to defibrillate him. So when I asked him, what happened to you, Bob? He said, God called me, and then he quickly changed his mind. And That's exactly what happened. We asked him, what happened to you? And he says, this was bliss. It was ecstasy. It was pure joy. And I asked him, that means you were aware. And he said, yes, I was aware. I've never been so aware in my life. I said, were you aware of anything in particular? He said, no, nothing in particular, but everything in general. So what he was describing was a non-local spiritual experience of being everywhere in space-time, an omnipresence, omniscience, omnipresence, omnipotence of being everywhere. That is, he not only slipped into the gap, but he went out here. And he could experience his immortal spirit everywhere in space and time. Now, as it turned out, his leg had burned as the current came out from his leg. And it was hurting him a lot. And there was a lot of burning and pain. And then he said he would think of this gift from God that he had received. The gift not of life, because he realized that this is life. And this is just an experience. And it wasn't the gift of life, it was the gift of knowledge of his own immortality. And he was filled with gratitude. And he was so filled with gratitude that every time he would think of the gift, he would go into the gap and then slip into that field. And then, like a true scientist, he started experimenting. He started going to the field and at the same time putting his attention on the leg, which had burnt and was hurting, but would now start tingling with a kind of a pleasurable sensation. Well, to make a long story short, over the course of a year, he healed his burnt leg, he grew new muscle fibers, he has a new leg. In fact, I just heard from him 2-3 weeks ago. He's a friend of mine, obviously now. And, you know, he went skiing 3 weeks ago. What did he do? Well, he went to the same place from where nature creates everything, whether it's a galaxy or a cluster of nebulas or a rainforest or a leg or a thought. And then what he also did was he developed the ability to maintain the simultaneity of non-local awareness and local awareness at the same time. Now, when we meditate, when we break our boundaries, we dip into the gap now and then. But if we get to a stage where we can experience that and waking, dreaming and sleeping, that experience, that simultaneity of transcendental consciousness along with waking, dreaming and sleeping, it's you're asleep but there's a part of you that's fully awake. Or you're dreaming and there's a part of you that's watching the dream. Or right now, we are in waking state of consciousness but there's a part of me in eternity. Or you're listening to me, your awareness is localized to me, but who's listening? Who's listening? And where is that one that's listening? Turn your attention right now to the one who's listening. And that's non-local, it's everywhere. That simultaneity of local and non-local awareness, which means an all-knowingness of everything in general and all things in particular at the same time, is called cosmic consciousness. And when we refine that a little bit, in that when I see this, and I see it in terms of its local value, which is at the localized concentration of that same infinite being, and in its universal value, then that's God consciousness. Because I see God in everything that I comprehend. And the, beyond that is unity where there's no difference.
The things that, the miracles that you hear of people manifesting, Christ raising the dead,
Sai Baba.
Sai Baba manifesting artifacts out of apparently nothingness. Are you saying that all of us have that within
yes,
us?
Yes, we all have it, and it's dependent on the quality of our attention. Because basically we are our attention. If our attention is only on the local, then that's all we see. Right this moment, most people in this room will take in less than 1/1,000,000,000 of the stimuli that are present in this room. Less than 1/1,000,000,000 of what's here right now will get into the nervous system of most people. And what gets in is that which reinforces their notion of what they think that is there. Your phrase, your famous phrase. You'll see it when you believe it. So they have the notion first,
right,
and then they see it. The nervous system otherwise edits it out. The more I break down my conceptual boundaries, because what I see is only my conceptual boundaries. The more I break them down, then more access I have to the field of pure potentiality from where I'm manifesting everything. So there are levels of degrees of ease with which we can manifest things. That example that you were...
Yeah, what I think of when I think about all these people watching is so many of them think that that's something that other people can do who are gifted and who are specially enlightened and who have special connections to God. But in fact, when you begin to meditate, or when you go within and discover that higher part of yourself, you soon discover that those things that we call synchronicity, or those things that we call miracles, are very much a part of our life. And after a while, you begin to see yourself doing things and knowing things that you thought were impossible before. And when you talk about Maharishi, who I know you're so close to, some of the things that he has directed you to do from his awareness and how they got manifested in the world. I mean, remember the story you told me about the Air India flight and the... can you talk about that here?
Do you want me?
Sure, I do. Yeah, it blew me away.
I've never told these stories in public, by the way.
That's why I got you up here.
This is about 5-6 years ago, and I was in Washington, and I'd met with the FDA about various things that we were doing with herbal medicine and Ayurvedic medicine. And that evening, I happened to speak on the phone with Maharishi, and he knew that I was going to India to see my mother, who wasn't feeling well. And he got me on the phone, and he was somewhere, I don't know where he was, non-local somewhere. And,
but he is real magic in action, isn't he? I mean, he's
all of us are.
Yeah, but he's at this level.
Yeah, definitely. So, he asked me where I was going. I said, I was going to India. And he said, well, if you're going to India, then you should meet the president and the vice president and the prime minister and the speaker of the house, and you should tell them all the stuff about Ayurvedic medicine. And while he's speaking to me on the phone, I'm saying to myself, how did he expect me to get an appointment with the president? You just don't go and knock on the door of the president of India and say, I want to talk to you about Ayurvedic medicine. Well, as it turned out, he kept me on the phone so long that I missed my flight. And I had to take another flight to LaGuardia and then switch to JFK. And I had an economy seat, and they had given it away because I was late. And then they felt sorry for me because I looked so tired and exhausted. And they put me in a first class seat, and I was sitting next to this Indian man who was having a cognac every 15 minutes as if it was doctor's orders. And... by the time we got to England, he was really sloshed. And when we took the flight off from England, he looked at me and he said, you don't like cognac? And I said, because I'm making my own. And he said, how do you do it? And I said, God, this fellow's drunk. I don't want to talk to him. But he kept after me, so I started telling him about my own experiences with meditation and Ayurveda, and I talked nonstop from London to Kuwait. I spoke nonstop, and when we left Kuwait and we were finally coming down in Delhi, he looks at me and he says, oh, by the way, would you like to meet the president, the vice president, the prime minister, and the speaker of the house? Mm. I said, who are you? And who sent you here? He said, oh, nothing. They had this Bhopal tragedy there those days. And, he was going to India with a check for $5 million or $3 million as part of a relief fund. And he had these meetings for him. And he said, but I don't know what to tell them. And now we can tell them this stuff and we'll go around all the circles. So that's the field of infinite correlation. When you slip into the gap, have the desire, release your attachment.
When Maharishi said to you, meet the president, and you had the doubt, what was his response?
I said,
How am
I going to meet them? And he said, you'll meet them. And then when I finished, I had met them. I called him all excited to tell him I'd met them. And he wasn't interested in listening to the story.
Yeah. Now, one other story like that. Because this place in Lancaster, which is Ayurveda in practice, which if you
it's
ever...
like my PR agent. Yeah.
Well, Marcy and I are going, along with Louise Hay, who is sponsoring a lot of our talks together around the country, again in May, and it's just a magnificent, healing, beautiful place. But wasn't it Maharishi who said, get a place in Massachusetts, get yourself 100 acres and get your...
Yeah, that's another story. I was in New York. Again, I've told you all these stories. I haven't ever...
But it's so phenomenal because I think we can lead into something with these stories.
Well, I was in New York City and I met some stockbroker who was the stockbroker for a certain film star who was there, and I happened to see her, and that day a lot of interest was generated suddenly in Ayurveda, especially the rejuvenation aspects of Ayurveda, a lot of interest. And I said to myself, you know, I have all this stuff to talk about, but there's no place. We don't have a place. So that evening, I called Maharshi and I spoke to him and I said, you know, Ayurveda is becoming very popular, but there isn't a place. I said, I think there's a retreat somewhere near where you live. Don't you live in Massachusetts? I said, yes. He said, well, in 1958, I remember, this is now, we're talking about 35 years later, there's a retreat somewhere near you, and you should go and see it. It would be really good. So I went there that night, and there were no lights, there were no heating in this place. And because it was it used to be a convent which had been sold to the TM people who had then sort of just used it as a retreat, and they weren't doing much with it. Heating bills weren't being paid, and lights weren't on, and so on. And I went there, and the building was kind of run down, but it had 150 acres of land around it, which we found out accidentally was part of the property. We didn't even know that. So we sold about 10, 15 acres of the land. We still have 130 left. With that, we raised a few $1 million and refurbished the whole thing, and now we have this facility.
Yeah.
Out of the blue.
Those people who know and have that knowing are able to treat it almost like childlike. My favorite story you ever told of Maharishi, because we think that you have to somehow become this adult and you have to be very mature, and you all talk about how childlike and almost infantile holy people, or people who, they don't lose that child within them. And you were having a meeting, was it in Belgium or something? And do you remember that? Or?
Yeah, I don't want to talk about it.
They brought in candy. Do you remember the...
Yeah.
And he acted like this little tiny child. He said, candy, you brought me candy. I mean, he went from perhaps one of the most brilliant people alive to this tiny little child who stopped this meeting you were meeting on transforming the world or something, and then just enjoyed his candy. So that it's like, this is something that's in every one of us.
It's the two aspects of childlike nature that holy men have. It's not childishness. Childishness is very different from being childlike. It's play and fantasy. Fantasize anything you want. Inherent in the fantasy is its materialization, because you don't have the same fantasies that I have. So that non-local field of information is expressing itself, localizing itself as your fantasies. I don't have those fantasies. I have other fantasies. But inherent in the fantasy is the whole mechanics of evolution of the materialization of that fantasy. That's one thing. And the other is playfulness, which means don't take life seriously. Don't take yourself seriously. because it's a recreational universe. The reasons why dolphins dance and cavort over the oceans, the reasons why stars sparkle at night, and the reasons why children play, and the reason why trees reach out to the sun, is that this is a playful recreational universe. And therefore, that the more we have that playfulness inside us, it's a play. The Vedic word for that is lila. Lila means play, divine play. God is playing a game of hide and seek, hiding herself to find herself.
Who was the little girl who could hear the whales or the?
Yeah, that's another story told to me by an English anthropologist, Irish anthropologist. He was looking for a certain species of whale to write about in his book. And he was traveling the South Seas, and he'd had a tough time spotting this particular whale. And one day he mentioned it to one of the village elders, who said, there's a girl here who's 13 years old, and she can fetch the whale for you. So he met her, and they were sitting on the beach, and they closed her eyes. She closed her eyes. He says about 20 minutes or so later, he started feeling his heart was pounding, because he saw over the horizon this big, huge whale. And then it came nearer and nearer and nearer, and finally it beached itself and at the feet of this girl, and they had to get the whole village out to put the whale back into the ocean. Afterwards, he went to this girl and he said, what did you do? And she said, it was very simple. I went to that place where we all speak the same language, and then I asked it to come. That's all. So next day, Dr. Watson was going fishing and he took the girl with him. And every few minutes she would put her head in the ocean, she'd say, let's go 10 miles this way. Let's go there and find what they were looking for. Then she'd put her head in the ocean, let's go 7 miles this way, and they'd find what they were looking for. So finally he couldn't resist it anymore. He put his head in the ocean, kept it there till he couldn't breathe anymore, and then took it out and looked at this girl and said, I couldn't hear anything. And she said, that's the trick. To hear the silence. It is the trick, because otherwise our internal dialogue is so noisy that it interferes with this transformational vortex, this corridor, this window that we have to the cosmic mind. So it's not important to have a positive idea, positive mind. You know, we hear so much about positive thinking. You've got to have a positive mind. And that's not what we're talking about, because a positive mind can be a very stressful mind. I have patients who are exasperatingly positive all the time. So much that they make me nervous.
They make you nervous? I want to talk. We'll talk about that in a minute.
Because positive mind, although it's better than a negative mind, it's still a turbulent mind. It's positive thoughts all the time. What we want is a quiet mind. And when the mind is silent, then one becomes a witness of both the positive and the negative. And one realizes that both the positive and the negative are aspects of the same thing. They are poles of opposites that make for a meaningful life. If there weren't villains, there wouldn't be any need for heroes. If there wasn't heart, there wouldn't be any cold. The whole universe is the lively coexistence of extreme opposites. And we have to quietly, somewhere deep inside us, reconcile ourselves quietly to that coexistence. And then we are at peace. Then we don't say this is good, this is bad. We lose the need to judge. We lose the need to judge. We relinquish the need to say this is right and this is wrong. This is good and this is bad. The two are necessarily aspects of the same God. God is the villain. God is the hero. God is the victim, the vanquished, and the conqueror, and everything. So once we get to that level, we just lose that need. And when you lose that need to judge, there's a nice prayer, it comes from the Course in Miracles. Today I shall judge nothing that occurs, for non-judgment creates silence in my mind. When I relinquish that need to just let go, because it's lively and it's wonderful and it's blissful because of the negativity and the positivity. If it was, there's another saying in Veda, a man who's born blind will never know the meaning of darkness. In order to know the meaning of darkness, you have to see light. So the two go together. And when I lose my need there, then I can experience bliss. Because bliss is not happiness. Happiness is always for a reason. It's a thought, a positive thought. I'm happy because you paid me a compliment. Or I'm happy because I made a lot of money. Or I'm happy because whatever, I won the lottery. But when I'm happy for no reason whatsoever, then I'm in bliss. And that comes from going beyond the poles of opposites.
You know, Joseph Campbell did a whole program, a whole series of, I don't know, did you ever meet him?
Yeah, a little bit. I loved him.
Yeah. On pursuing your bliss. I've often felt as I talk to salespeople and business people around the world that so many of them are looking to set goals and to find out the way to make money and to get the things that they want for themselves. And I always think about bliss as what you have to do first is fall in love with what you do. And then what you sell is that love. You don't sell what you do. You don't sell your product. You transform yourself as someone who's out there giving away bliss. And many of you have heard me talk over the years about the orange. When you squeeze an orange, what comes out is orange juice, because that's what's inside. And the same metaphor expands. It doesn't matter what time of day you squeeze it. It doesn't matter what instrument you use. It doesn't matter what the circumstances are. When you squeeze an orange, you get what's inside. Well, when someone squeezes you, and out of you comes anger or frustration or bitterness or non-bliss, it really isn't because of who did the squeezing. As much as we like to convince ourselves that that's what's causing us to have non-bliss, it's because that's what's inside. And how that gets inside, I use the thing as if this were my car key, and I'm in my house, and I were to, and it's dark in the house, and I were to drop my key, and I look around for a while, and I say, well, I'm not going to look in here. It's dark. But I notice that outside, there's a street light, so I go out under the street light, and I'm out here, and I'm looking for my key. And a friend of mine comes along and says, Wayne, what happened? I said, well, I dropped my key and I can't find it. And well, I'll help you find it. And we looked for a half an hour, and finally he said to me, well, where did you drop it? I said, well, I dropped it in the house, but there's no light in there, so I came out here to look under. I said, well, you mean to tell me you dropped your key in there, but you're looking for it out here? I said, well, yeah, because the light is here. Now, that makes as much sense, but isn't that what we do when we have a problem that is in here and we look for the solution out there, when we're looking for the answer in a place? The answer has to be where the problem is. And if bliss is in here because of the way you have chosen, is that how you chosen to process the world, then that's all you'll have to give away. And when the stuff, the negative stuff comes into your life, as it will, at least I found that it will. I mean, it's hills and valleys. It's about getting annihilated. And then thinking that you got it made, and then another annihilation comes along, and how you deal with that and how you grow from that. But if you believe that your inner world is the result of what other people are saying or doing, what I think you have to do is develop an inner candle flame, you know, that never flickers, though the worst goes before you. I don't pretend to be able to do that at all times, but I'm a lot better at it than I used to be.
Yeah, and the thing to remember is it's okay to have all the negativity. It's okay to feel angry, and it's okay to feel negative, but to realize that that's part of a spectrum and that there is other parts of the scenery. They're both there, and we reconcile ourselves to their coexistence. That's the important thing. And the universe is always sending out two messages. Always. You don't have to really even be intellectual about this. There's one message that is inside the body. It's a message of comfort. And there's another message inside the body that's one of discomfort. These are the only two messages we get. And you don't have to be intellectual, as I said. Just tune into your physical body. Spirituality is an extremely sensual experience. And there's another, this is a different idea than most people have. They separate the senses from and sensuality from spirituality, from consciousness. But if the body is the product of that consciousness, then to be grounded in the body, in your own sensuality even, is to be grounded in the present, in the presence of God. And to therefore structure your behavior in such a way that it amplifies the bliss, as Campbell said, follow the bliss, amplify the signal of comfort in your physical body, and do things that do not give you the experience of discomfort in your physical body, and you're on the path to spirituality.
When you were talking this morning, you said, you mentioned not only is it stranger than we think, it's stranger than we can think, and that it's a thinking universe. In fact, you mentioned the other day that someday you'd like to write something like that, that it's a thinking universe. One thing that you did with me one time was to talk about the thinking body. Mm-hmm. That most of us really and truly do think that our thinking takes place in the brain, and that's all, and that's where thought originates, and that somehow that is, and that the rest of the body doesn't think. But let's use an example, like right now. As a matter of fact, it's under the lights and everything, and I'm thirsty. Okay, what's going on in my body? I mean, to prove that the body is thinking all over the place.
So as soon as you have that idea, I am thirsty, then your brain, your cortex, it makes a peptide, a protein called angiotensin 2. And that angiotensin 2, it influences your behavior in such a way that you start looking for water.
Which is what I'm going to do while you're talking.
You start looking for water. At the same time, there's another part of your brain called the hypothalamus, and that also secretes angiotensin 2. That makes the hypothalamus secrete a hormone called ADH, antidiuretic hormone, that makes your body hold on to water. At the same time, your kidneys make angiotensin 2, so you don't lose it in the urine, you hold on to it. At the same time, your skin cells make angiotensin 2, so you don't sweat as much, you hold on to the water in the skin. Your lungs make it, so the lungs start saying to themselves, I need water. You don't lose water in the breaths. Your heart cells make it. In other words, as soon as you had the idea, I want water, it was simultaneously everywhere in all the cells of your body at the same time. It didn't first occur here in English or Swahili. It occurred everywhere at the same time. So it was omnipresent. And the scientific term for this is thinking, therefore, is a non-local phenomenon. Even though we think it's local, it's localized to the brain, it's not. Because the mind isn't in the brain. The mind is expressing itself as the body, which is a space-time event everywhere, all at the same time. In other words, every thought is omniscient, it's omnipresent, it's omnipotent. Now, where was that thought, I am thirsty or I want water, before you had it? Where was it? It was a probability amplitude in the gap. And where was it before that? Everywhere and nowhere at the same time. Just a pure field potentiality. Then when that field began to interact, became a probability amplitude, which is the wave, and in the frozen moment of attention, it became the particle, which is the material form. But the material form, which is that which ultimately expresses itself as material reality, the wave and the field are all the same thing. They're just some different manifestations.
So that every part of my body is thinking all the time.
All the time.
Now, can my body, let's say I'm feeling tense and I need a Valium. Can my body... I'm feeling tense and I want to have a Valium, or I want to have some kind of tranquilizer or whatever. Can my body, am I capable, if I learn how to get to this higher place, which we're going to get to, and manufacture that for myself without having to go to the drugstore?
At a deep level of awareness, if you have this notion, and it's a notion, it's just an idea, that I'm having the experience of tranquility, then your body will indeed make Valium. The only thing is, it won't make it in such doses that you'll feel like a zombie.
Mm.
It'll make it in the precise dose that's necessary to allow your cells to do the job in tranquility. When you're feeling jittery, then your body will make jittery molecules like adrenaline, and it won't make it just from the adrenal gland. It makes little platelets will make adrenaline. These are frightened platelets that are huddling together because they're scared. Mm. If you're feeling... That's
they laugh, but that's true, isn't it? I mean, that truly
that's
is
how
going
the clotting cascade starts. And if you're feeling exhilarated, then as I said earlier, you're making interleukins and interferons, which are and very powerful anti-cancer drugs. Now, I go on a joyride, let's say on Magic Mountain, and I make interleukins, but somebody else goes and they don't. They make adrenaline. It's not the joyride.
Mm.
It's my interpretation of the joyride. Now, it's easy to say, therefore change your interpretation, but realize that our interpretations are also products of our childhood and our cultural indoctrination, what our parents told us, what religion tells us, what belief in dogma and ideology of our society tells us. So even though we say change it, it's not like you can do it instantly, but one thing you can do is begin to have the insight that it's interactions. One thing I tell some patients of mine is, look around you and look at the universe as if it was 360 degrees of mirrors. So every situation in the environment is me interacting with myself and experiencing it as this situation, this person, this thing. So everything in, I'm looking at the 360 degrees of mirrors where I'm seeing myself expressing as all this diversity. And now I say, if this is not a pleasant message that I'm getting, then what am I doing that I should change? It's not wrong. It's just, you know, there's no right and wrong. Let's get that straight. There's no right and wrong. There's no evil and there's good. It's just not so pleasant, that's all. And I prefer to the pleasant to the unpleasant. I choose my behaviors in such a way that I amplify the signal of comfort. Three things that I tell my patients sometimes if they have serious illness. Three simple things to do. One, meditate regularly, every day. It gives you access to the gap and the silence. Two, for a while just be silent. Take a patient and put him in 2 weeks, 3 weeks of silence. Maharshi went into silence for 13 years in a cave. We don't have to do that. Don't worry. And
did you say 13 years?
13 years he was in silence. And his teacher, Gurudev, was in silence for 40 years in the forest. When they finally went to get him, in the, you know, because they had... the president of India wanted to honor him for something, and they, he was the next in line for a certain post, spiritual post. Even spiritual people have politics. And he was in the line for that. And they went to get him in the forest. He'd been in silence for 40 years. And they said the tigers would come by and sit next to him. And snakes had wrapped themselves around his legs. And birds would light on his hand. And somebody said, you know, Gurudev, all these snakes, poisonous snakes and cobras around you. What do you mean, cobras and poisonous snakes? All I see is God. He could just experience that, and therefore, when he was so firmly established in non-violence, as the Vedic Sutra, when we are firmly established in non-violence, then all beings around us cease to feel hostility. They become incapable of experiencing it in our presence. And he was he was 40 years in silence. Well, I tell my patients, let's do 2 weeks. And if you can't do 2 weeks, let's do 1 week. And if you can't do 1 week, let's do 1 day at a time. Just wear a little button over here. I'm in silence. And when people go into silence, then mind becomes very turbulent in the beginning. Because all these things you need to say. One fellow came to me and he said, if I don't call my girlfriend and wish her happy birthday, I'll die. So I said, well, make that call and then we'll go into silence. that's the second thing. Meditation, going into silence. And third, very important, get away from the need to define or label or describe or interpret or analyze or evaluate. In other words, lose the need, relinquish the need to judge. When you stop judging, everything falls into place.
Mm. That's good advice. It really is. I remember in reading Return of the Rishi, was that your first? That was the first?
Second.
You talked about being a little boy in a village in India, and this guy came through, and they buried him. I think the name of the chapter is Today We Buried a Saint. Tell him, I mean, that just fascinates me, that a human being can train themselves to do this. I love this. This is in your book. Don't tell me this is a secret. It's got more secrets. It's I'm going to tell you something, but you can't tell anyone. And before you, then he's on Geraldo talking about it.
My mother is very fond of visiting spiritual people, and my mother is an extremely spiritual person. In fact, a few years ago, she went to a cave in the Himalayas, and the legend is that if God wants to manifest himself in that cave, then Shiva manifests as a rearing cobra about 6 inches in front of you with its fangs open. And any other person would be petrified of that experience. When she went into that cave, she meditated there for a few hours. And then this cobra appeared and came down, this big Shiva lingam, slithered down, came right to where she was and stood right 6 inches in front of her like this with its fangs open. And she had tears in her eyes because she knew that she had manifested God.
Wow.
And then, of course, the cobra slithered away. But we had a neighbor who was a Swami, and every few seasons, he would go into samadhi, the experience of silence, go into meditation, close his eyes, and then he would be in that for a week, 10 days, 2 weeks, sitting in one place. And his metabolic rate would slow down to zero. Because when thought comes to a standstill and you're in that gap, then everything comes to a standstill. Time comes to a standstill. No thinking and yet an awareness. But I wasn't sophisticated enough to understand that. I was a medical student. I went to him, I said, Swamiji, when you don't have a heartbeat and your oxygen consumption is zero, and your basal metabolic rate is zero, then that's death. He said, no, my son, that's the experience of immortality. Because it's not an extinction. It's an alive awareness in which all time, all knowledge coexists in a continuum, this past, present, future. It's a huge screen of consciousness. And the Vedic expression is, when I'm grounded in this screen of consciousness, then I notice that infinite worlds come and go on the vast expanse of my consciousness like motes of dust in a beam of light that's shining through the roof. And then I realize that this is just another little event in space-time. Which doesn't mean that I lose my interest in this or I don't enjoy it anymore. In fact, I enjoy it much more, because behind me there is the security that when this is over, it's not the end. It's just act 5, scene 5 of this particular drama. And when I'm not so involved in the drama that I forget who I am, that I'm the actor and not the character that's in the play, then the one thing that happens is that the hysteria goes. You lose the hysteria. And that is enough. As long as life ceases to be hysterical, that's the beginning, you know, because most people's lives are so hysterical. It's just one hysterical scene followed by another. Mm.
Marianne Williamson, in her new book, Return to Love, which is really wonderful, I think, has a great quote in there. She said, that there's purpose to all of this, and God's plan works, and yours doesn't. So get yourself in tune with God's plan. But tell them about how they buried that saint in your village. I want them to tell you that.
Well,
that just blew me away.
I was a third-year medical student, and we had this saint who came from the Himalayas, and we persuaded him that we would be able to experiment with him. And we put him in a coffin, and we dug a hole 6 feet into the ground and put him there and covered the ground with dust. And 6 days later, we dug him out. And as we opened the coffin, very slowly you start seeing, he was hooked on to EEGs and heart EKGs and so on. And during this period, there was absolutely no electrical activity of his heart. And after 6 days, when he came out, his heart started to flicker just a bit. And then he slowly opened his eyes. He said, could I have a glass of milk, please? After 6 days. He went into the transcendental state of consciousness and maintained it there for 6 days. And see, aging occurs not in the gap, but in the space-time events. Aging occurs in these space-time events. In the gap is where time is manufactured. Time is manufactured in the gap here. So I'll give you an example of how we manufacture time. I read this case report from Germany recently where 7 miners were trapped in a mine. And all of them had a watch except for one person. And he didn't want the others to get scared. In order to allay their anxieties, every time 2 hours went by, he would call out 1 hour. At the end of the week, they were rescued and all of them were alive except for the one who was calling out the time. He had them change their collective agreement as to what constituted time. It's an agreement. And then they aged accordingly, and he couldn't fool himself because he had a watch. You notice why I don't wear a watch, right? So, what...
He's always asking me what time it is, though.
So
now I know why I'm here. I'm the shill here.
So... Now my physical body, which is made up of quite ordinary carbon and hydrogen and oxygen and nitrogen, if you had to buy the raw material from hardware stores, if you had to go to a hardware store and buy the basic ingredients of my body, it could cost you $7. With inflation, maybe $9. So the physical body, the raw material that makes up my body, the carbon and the hydrogen with the recycled earth, water and air, it's been the same for thousands of years. The carbon I have in my bones right now was the same carbon that was in a cluster of nebulas millennia ago, before the Big Bang, etc. It's the same raw material. And carbon and hydrogen and oxygen cannot age. They haven't. A sugar molecule, which is also what makes up my body, or protein molecule, which are basically carbon, hydrogen, nitrogen, oxygen, selenium, tin, whatever, they can't age. Those elements don't age. So why do I? Why do I? Even if the basic raw material that makes up my body doesn't age, why do I age? Because aging is not on the level of matter. Aging is on the gap. See, what's the difference between carbon and hydrogen or oxygen? Anything. One element or another. It's just the arrangement of the subatomic particles. Just like in the DNA, which is the code of information, it's not the nucleotides, it's the arrangement, it's the sequence.
Right.
The sequence is in the gap, which is, this gap is qualitatively different from this gap. By virtue of what? By virtue of just a faint intention which is freezing that field of infinite possibilities into a certain manifestation. So aging and entropy are a function of how we structure time in the gap. And if we could learn how to, even at a deep level, if we had a different concept of time as other cultures have. No, Dr. Alexander Lee from Harvard went to all these other places like the Hindu Kush Mountains, Soviet Georgia, Abkhazia, and all these places in Siberia. Different spectrum of aging. 110-year-olds, 115-year-olds riding horses, swimming naked in ice-cold streams, what was different? It wasn't their diet. In fact, if you give Eskimos vegetarian food and fruit and vegetables, they get rotten teeth, hardening of the arteries, and bad tempers. So it's not the diet. It influences us, but it's not that. In these cultures, they had a different concept of what it meant to age and of time. To grow old was to become wiser, to become more respected, to become more loved, to become venerated. If you were old, then you were glamorous. All the young people envied the old. And that translated into a different conception of time, a different processing of time, which is nothing physical, different metabolism of time, different kind of aging. How we conceive time, process it, and metabolize it influences that entropy which is not on the level of matter. And time is a self-interaction generated in the gap. It's generated in the gap. Therefore, if at the deep level our view of time changes, that causes a mutation in our consciousness. That mutation causes a mutation in the mind, which expresses itself as a biological mutation. There are other cultures where they have a view of circular time. They don't think in terms of linear time. They think of all activity as circular. So rest, activity, rest, activity, rest, activity, rest. The earth is spinning and spinning and spinning. What's the difference between yesterday and today and tomorrow? The same earth is just spinning on its own axis. The seasons, they come and go. So spring follows winter, and then there's autumn, and there's winter, and fall, and spring, and it keeps going round and round in a circle. And they view that as circular. And the whole notion of time, it's circular. Completely different physiology as a result of that experience that time is not linear. The New Guinea Islanders, they don't have a word in their vocabulary. They don't have a word in their vocabulary for getting lost. You know, there isn't a word, which means there is no such interpretation. Well, these New Guinea Islanders have never had the experience of getting lost.
Right, so you can...
Because they are in a non-local universe where every place is home.
It's the same with the Native Americans when we tried to buy their land from them.
Exactly, they, Chief Seattle. Yeah, that's, they, you they might
had,
tell them about it.
They had absolutely no concept in their language for the purchase of land. I mean, how can you own land? You want to give me money for something that you can never own? God owns the land. And sure, we'll take it, but how can it be yours? They just didn't get it. Even reservations, that whole concept, they never talked like that.
By the way, before I forget, people have been asking me all morning and all afternoon, I just want to introduce to you Dr. Reddy, who is a friend of mine, has worked with me for many, many years. Please stand up, Hema. And she's fully trained in Ayurveda. She's running our Ayurvedic clinic here. And everything I say, she can practice it. I can only say it. She can practice it and better. So I just want you to know for her presence. Thank you.
When you say the word Ayurveda, what does that translate to?
The word Ayurveda comes from the two Sanskrit roots, Ayus, which means life, Veda, which means knowledge. So Ayurveda means knowledge of life. And it wasn't gleaned from going and dissecting the universe into bits and fragments. It came from cognition, from that knowingness that you speak of, from just being silent, and then everything is there.
We were talking about using the example of strawberry ice cream, which seems to be both of our favorite flavors. And if you wanted, let's say you wanted strawberry ice cream. You're all here in this room today and you wanted to have some strawberry ice cream. And we were talking about how many ways are there to get strawberry ice cream if you want to get it into your world. I mean, literal potential ways for you to have a dish of strawberry ice cream. And the first way is the way that all of you know. That is, you have a thought. It always, as Emerson said, the ancestor to every action is a thought. All right? You have this somehow, the thought, and then there's the thinker of the thought. So the thought is, like, I just wanted some water. I'd like to have some strawberry ice cream. And then you get in your car and you drive over to Haagen-Dazs, or you get on your bicycle, or you go for a walk, and you get yourself some strawberry ice cream. So you act upon that thought. Now, that's the lowest level of higher consciousness. I mean, there's not a vegetable plant that knows how to do that. No stone will ever do that. An animal won't do that. But you know how to do that. So that's higher consciousness, but it's still the lower level. And there's there are many higher levels than that, or there are three, that the three beyond that we're talking about. Another way, if you want to have strawberry ice cream, is to have a thought, gee, I'd like to have some strawberry ice cream. And a higher consciousness way is to say to one of your kids, go get me some strawberry ice cream. So that you have the thought and somebody else is acting on it, which is really terrific. It was outlawed. It's called slavery, but it's still a way of getting strawberry ice cream into your life. But the next way, I think, is the more interesting way.
Well, then the next way is that you have the thought and your friend goes by and he says, hey, Deepak, would you like some strawberry ice cream? I just went to the grocery store and I got some. And then there's a better way. You have the thought and you open the refrigerator, it's there. There's a better way. You have the thought and you turn around and it's there. And then there's an even better way. You have the thought and you manifest it right before your eyes. And it all is a function of how local and non-local you can be at the same time. See, if your attention is always on the relative, then it's the relative is the field of change. Then all you see is change, change, change. Mm. If your attention is on the absolute, then it's non-change. The absolute is the ground of all change. And that is fine, it's great, because it gives you the experience of immortality, but it could get boring after a while. And I said, hey, you know, forever and ever, non-change. When you have it simultaneously on the relative and the absolute, therein that every experience is experienced in terms of its boundaries, but at the same time in terms of its unboundedness, then you've got it.
Now, this is something that I've experienced in my life a lot more lately that I've been able to go to this level. This is difficult for him to handle here. But, and what I suggest is that when you get to this place that we're alluding to here, which is not a place, that these kinds of events of people walking by and saying, is this your strawberry ice cream? And you say, wow, I was just thinking about that. Ooh, what's going on? How did that happen? Where did that come from? Or you're thinking about your sister and you're just having a conversation with her. You haven't seen her in 5 years and you go to the phone and she's calling, or, you know, endless numbers of these kinds of synchronistic events that almost like you have a collaboration with fate, become more frequent, they become more noticeable, they aren't something that you say, oh, how could this happen, isn't that interesting, or it's just chaos, because there's no such thing as chaos.
No,
is there?
It's only the appearance of chaos. There is nothing in chaos. It's like when you go to, say, let's say you go to New York City, and the best example I can use of chaos is Grand Central Station. Okay,
yeah.
So everybody is going hither and thither every which way and what, and you think it's chaotic. But each person is going to a specific destination.
Mm.
And not only that, if you were to announce a track change from track 11 to track 10, you'd see a further intensification of the chaos.
Mm.
But in fact, it is an elaboration of the underlying order.
Mm.
So in all this seeming chaos, there's an underlying order. And it's not only that you should go and get flowers wherever you go.
Mm.
The Vedic expression is, when you're in that state, then wherever you go, flowers will bloom.
Mm. Yeah.
You don't have to wait for them. You choose where you want to go, and the flowers will bloom on your path.
Yeah, I believe that. I mean, I know that. I do. And I've seen it happen, and I believe you can take this kind of consciousness and make it work not only for you but for those around you or for the world, that the thoughts, the images, the vision, the ability to manifest, to create what you want for yourself. You see, if enough of us in the world believe, for example, in a nuclear holocaust, just taking it to something that affects all of us and certainly all of our children who are going to inherit this place from us, if enough of us believe that, that exists, doesn't it? I mean, that's a consciousness. And if enough of us believe it, we will collectively begin to act upon that consciousness, that fear, if you will. Because fear is really, there's like fear and love in there. You know, I mean, hate isn't the opposite of love. Fear is the opposite of love. When you eradicate the fear, like if I'm afraid of something happening, an opinion that somebody might have of me, somebody doing something to me that might not, somebody taking my money away from me, somebody, an IRS audit, whatever it may be that is fearful, I'm creating those pheromones that you were talking about, those fearful pheromones. I like that. That could be a rock group. You know? The fearful pheromones. Watch. They'll be on TV tomorrow. You create that. When I have that fearful thought, I find myself, I use a technique that I'm writing about in Real Magic where I just say, I use the word next. It's like, okay, here's that thought, and I say to myself, next. Like that thought, I don't need any, I don't need that fearful thought, or that fearful thought is going to create the very thing that it is that I'm anticipating. So I just remind myself of next. And the stress inside, the anxiety, whatever, seems to dissipate, and I substitute fear with love, with harmony, with bliss, with ease, with whatever you want to call that. And the minute that I do that, the minute that I just shift that thought, my physiology changes. I am creating molecules with my mind that create love and harmony instead of fear, and the problem is gone.
So this quantum mechanical body that I've been speaking about is nothing new. Ancients called it the subtle body and the causal body. It's that which survives your physical deaths. When two people are talking on the phone, you come up and cut the lines off, what happens to the people? Nothing happens. They're still there. Certain lines of communication have been disrupted for the time being. Or if we were to destroy the walls, which we would never do it, but let's say an earthquake came and destroyed the walls and the roof, what would happen to this space? Nothing. And this is the room, is the space that we are in. Likewise, when the physical body dies, nothing happens to you because you don't live in the physical body. The body lives in you. And the body is that chit akash, that subtle body. Chit in Sanskrit means full of thinking non-stuff. Akash means space, emptiness. Mm-hmm. And when speaking of this body, the rishis say, fire cannot burn it, water cannot wet it, wind cannot dry it, weapons cannot cleave it, it's ancient, it's unborn, it never dies. And yet, even though it's made up of non-stuff, and thinking non-stuff, it has in it all the seeds of every manifestation. When you close your eyes and you see an image flash through the screen of your consciousness, let's say you close your eyes right now and see your mother there, or somebody else, your child, or your sweetheart, or whatever. As soon as you see that image, where is that image? Or when you hear a thought, where is that thought? Or you touch and feel the texture of a rose in consciousness, or the taste of strawberry ice cream. Where is it? It's not in the material world. It's in Chitakash. It's in that quantum mechanical body. And that is the seed for manifestation. That seed, in its most primordial state, is nothing but a desire. And desire is pure potentiality seeking manifestation. It is the mechanics of creation. And both desire and memory are exactly the same. Desire leads to new memories, and new memories create more desires, etc., etc. So again, the spiritual admonition frequently, lose your desires, is a complete misunderstanding of reality. Without desire, there is no manifestation. Desire is the process. Pure being desiring to itself, may I become the mountains, became the mountains. Pure being desiring to itself, may I become the galaxies, became the galaxies. So it's not that we relinquish our desires. That would be very harmful. In fact, in Ayurveda, they say one of the reasons people get ill is they're unable to manifest their desires. And the secret of perfect health is the spontaneous fulfillment of every desire that you've ever had. Mm. And the easier the desire is to fulfill, the healthier you will be. So one never curbs one's desires, one just finds a better means of manifesting them. And the principle is not through hard work. Hard work can create a lot of stress, and it's part of this ethics that we've inherited, at least in this part of the world, right, that the harder you work, the better it will be. Well, where do you see that principle in nature? Does nature work hard? Does it have to really work hard to go around the sun every day, or for the birds to migrate, or the fish to go back to their spawning ground? It's all happening with the principle of do less and accomplish more. And ultimately, do nothing and accomplish everything. Then you're there.
There's one wonderful story you tell of the rishis who, a student goes to the rishi and said, I would like to know how long it will take me to, I'm very anxious and I want to learn enlightenment. And the rishi said, if you study with me for 10 years, you'll be there. He said, well, I want to work extra hard. He said, I will work at night, I will work in the day, I will study, I will do everything that I have to can. And the rishi said, 20 years. Deepak, I know that there's no such thing as time, but American Airlines is not at the same level that we are.
Okay, there's a quote from Eliot that I think summarizes this in a sense, mm-hmm, that really there's nothing to do. After all this, the final message is, there's nothing to do, because as Wayne says, I'm quoting him again, we're not human doings, we're human beings. Mm. And therefore there's nothing to do. And T.S. Eliot says, we shall not cease from exploration, and the end of our exploring will be to arrive where we started from and know the place for the first time. Mm. Thank you.
Thank you, Deepak. My favorite poet is Robert Frost, and he said similar message for all of us. And it's like, what I want to say in closing is, if you got what you got out of today is valuable, then understand that the thinker behind the thoughts and every thought you have is something to be really aware of, because you're going to manifest in your life exactly what it is that you're thinking. So get real conscious of that. And go to that empty place. Robert Frost said it this way. We all sit around in a ring and suppose, while the secret sits in the center and knows. Thank you, and God bless you.